Blog Talk Radio.
Anatomy of oppression and colonialism requires an analysis of the statement, Black Lives Matters. Our demands are freedom for our political prisoners, ourselves and our community, control of public schools, and, of course, everyone knows cats don't educate mice, they eat them. So unless we have community control, we will never have truth. We will never have enlightenment. We will never have reality. And tonight we hope you will listen and call in to 347-857-3293. Today we had the UN do a special session, an analysis or exploration of with different panels to discuss the whole issue of the recent police murders of the citizens of color in the United States and all over the world. They were looking at structural, what they call structural racism of African Americans toward African Americans all over the world. I say that to say one thing which was of interest. And they were talking about Black Lives Matter and that phrase. One of the things that was mentioned by one of the keynote speakers was many people say, well, it's not just Black lives that matter, all lives matter. And the only thing decent I could take away from the conference was the response to that, which was when there's a fire and the fire truck shows up in your neighborhood, do you send them to every single house because every house matters? Or do you send them to the house that's on fire? And let us recognize that when it comes to black houses, we've been on fire for over 500 years. And my main criticism of this structural racism panel held by at the UN today was nowhere did anyone, until we raised it, those of us who had questions from the audience, critique the fact nobody mentioned imperialism. Nobody mentioned racism from the point of view of imperialism and colonialism, which was where the whole concept of race got started. However, with having said that, we're going to now turn the mic over to the man of the hour, the we call our general, our theologian, if you will, for the spiritual uplifting of those who fight and struggle for the movement. I'm going to ask Brother Ralph Pointer if he will now give us his creed.
Hello and good evening, brothers and sisters. As Ralph Shulman said many times when he was speaking, and as the Honorable, the great American Ward Churchill, the indigenous spokesman for the indigenous people, would say, my family. And I say, my people. And my people are all of those progressive people who are fighting for justice for everyone, for the most radical position in the world, and that is true democracy for everyone. But with that said, let me go to what I believe. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labor for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police as the army of occupation have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. Now, having said that, and I stand by that, let me move on to what I'm sure everyone has been forced to think about, and that is the elections. Now, as you will hear on this program, said by people a long time ago, that if elections could change anything in America, they would be banned. But I say, the election cycle this year has been news to me. New chapters have been, or new lows, let me put it that way, new lows are being reached in this election process, and they will go even further. And I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about, and maybe later on in the program I'll have a chance to speak about what these elections mean. And I will say that I'm learning things as I watch and participate in this election process. One of the things that I learned 8 years ago is that a black man can be as duplicitous and hypocritical as a white man can be in the position of president, and maybe even outdoing the white president we had before, George Walker Bush. Hello. And he may have outdone Bush. And now we have Ben Carson, a black man running on the Republican ticket. And he has proven to be as hypocritical as the rest, a doctor flip-flopping on abortion. He's not sure what side he's on, but he's sure he's going to pick the side where he thinks he can get the most votes. And saying foolish things like killing babies. I mean, come on, man. But anyway, let's continue with this program, and I'm sure the elections are going to come up. And last week we had Larry Pinkney felt insulted by Nellie Bailey. And Nellie Bailey called me after the program to say she would never say anything to insult a person of the stature of Larry Pinkney. We all know Larry, but Nellie did not. And I do believe she was misinterpreted. She was certainly not talking about Larry Pinkney, and she called me up to make that very clear. Larry, are you with us?
Yes, hello? I am with you, my brother. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Did you hear me, what I was saying, how Nellie had called me after the program last week?
I did. I did indeed, and I convey my love and respect to Sister Nellie. Just because we may have differences or differences of interpretation does not by any means mean that we are enemies. We are allies. We are on the same page, as I said to Nellie last week. So quite frankly, I convey my love and respect to Sister Nellie and all of those who are engaged in this struggle. She has been engaged in the struggle. She is a brilliant writer and speaker, and I give her kudos and much respect for that. And having said that, I want to ask you, brother, should I go on to present that which I had prepared to present tonight?
Yes, you should. I would, you know, like you have said so many things over the years that, you know, it, as I said, I am so tired of saying, Larry, you told me so. But go ahead and tell us again some of the things that you predicted that came on, that came to our attention many years ago. You wrote about them. You talked about what would happen, and it is happening. And I say that with tongue in cheek. I am so glad to have you around to say, Ralph, be careful, because this is what's going to happen. And I smile when I say, I'm tired of making that mistake and having you to correct me so that I don't make the next mistake. So go, come on, Larry, just bring it up, bring it to us.
Well, you know, as so many have said before us, we are truly tired of being tired. And, you know, we don't have to be tired of being tired. We can do something about it. We must do something about it. And tonight I'd like to give an example of the people's victory, the people's victory, black, white, brown, red, yellow, the people's victory, everyday, ordinary people. I want to talk about our beloved sister, Lynn Stewart. I want to talk about how, and you know this, Ralph, how people told both you and me and others, told us that, oh, they'll never let Lynn Stewart out. Why, they're charged her with this and that. And you and I and others responded by saying, get a life, because we are not going to give up until we bring our sister home. All right? Home.
Right on, because right on. You and so many others, a lovely wife with that map of love that I presented every place that I went after she had done it. And it is a wonderful testament to what can be done when people put their shoulder to the wheel, put their mind to getting something done. And that's going to be a part of our discussion tonight and every night, that discussion of freeing all of our political prisoners. But continue. Excuse the interruption.
No interruption at all. Just an amendment. Much appreciated amendment, I might add. You know, I myself, and I think all of us, sometimes stop and go, my God, this is an uphill battle. Of course it's an uphill battle, and will continue to be an uphill battle until we have leveled the hill. I say again, it will continue to be an uphill battle until we have leveled the hill. And let me give an example of what I mean by that. Of course all lives matter, but all lives can't matter unless black lives matter. And black lives can't matter, as you've said repeatedly, Brother Ralph, unless they matter to black people. I mean, you know, the equation is very, very simple. One does not have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. When we begin to actualize our support, and the key word is actualize, our support and determination on behalf of all of our political prisoners, be it Mumia Abdul-Jamal, be it Leonard Peltier, be it, I mean, oh, it's an endless list. Okay, as Gil Scott-Heron would say, that won't be missed. But, you know, when we begin to actualize that, then we stand up as human beings, as humans. And until we do that, how can we expect anyone else to do that? Why, that would be absurd. That would be ludicrous. It would be ridiculous. We, everyday ordinary black folk, and our allies, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, we must stand up. We must step up to the plate. You know, this is what this struggle is truly, truly, truly all about. Today I read something that just shook me, and I had to write back to the source. I saw this rapper / spoken word entertainer. I believe his name is, quote, Prince E, that's E-A, who began a video by saying, "I am not black." And I understood what he was trying to say, but he should have said it instead of saying, "I am not black," he should have said, "I am human." And to be human as a black person requires that I take action. So I ended up, of course, spending almost 2 hours writing a response to the particular broadcast station that it was on. I don't know what's going to happen and really don't care. But at least I put the response out there. I go back, Ralph, to what you have repeatedly said. Black lives will only matter when they matter to we, black folk. And of course, if they matter to us, then they will begin to matter to everyone. And yes, if all lives matter, and they do, then black lives, and I listen closely to what our dear sister Betty said, if the house is on fire, we need to put the fire out. And right now, we are, using a loose term, the vanguard of that fire. It must be put out. So having said that, I want to refer people, I want to inspire people tonight. I want people to look at an article called Black Panther Party History Month, which, by the way, Black Panther Party History Month is every October because the party was founded in October of 1966. Anyway, the article is entitled Black Panther Party History Month and Political Prisoners in the U.S. And read it. I think it will inspire you. Our beloved sister Lynn is written about in that article, and it shows that there's no such thing as impossible. I repeat, there is no such thing as impossible, particularly as the struggle of oppressed peoples are concerned. If we ourselves submit to giving up and giving in, then it's not impossible. It's our submission that has not brought about systemic change, has not freed our political prisoners, has not brought about economic, political, and social change on a systemic, not a personality, but a systemic level. So I'm not going to take up a lot of time. I've probably taken too much as it is. I just want to finish by asking people to please Google the article. It's an Intrepid Report, Black Panther Party History Month and Political Prisoners in the U.S. The article actually came out in October, of course, of 2013. I thank you all. I love you all. I thank the listening audience. And as always, Brother Ralph, I thank you, I thank Sister Betty, and I will always thank our beloved Sister Lynn Stewart. All power to the people. Thank you so very, very much.
Hey, thank you for that, Larry. And one of the things that, we must go to Sister Lynn, but before that, I would like to say about 5 years ago in Rochester, New York, an eighth grade student wrote an essay on Frederick Douglass and how it relates to today. Well, she won the award given out by the committee that was celebrating Frederick Douglass. He had a home in Rochester. But then she ran into a beehive of disapproval in the Rochester school system. And she ended up transferring out of that system. But it was an education for everyone, because one of her conclusions were, nothing has changed. The issues are still the same today as they were when Frederick Douglass wrote a paper on this problem of racism. And one of our dear friends and supporters of Lynn Stewart, Mary Adams, and her husband, who stay with us, they've come down from Rochester to participate in events in New York and in Washington, D.C. This was her first year as an elected school board official. And she was shocked and saddened because she happens to be white and her husband happens to be black. But she was shocked and saddened at the response of her school board and the other members on the school board. So it was a learning situation for her as well as for the rest of us. She got the lesson, and she's working on improving the education system in Rochester, New York. And I say, now, what have the rest of us learned from this situation? And I tell you, one of the things that just keeps coming back to my mind when I talk about political prisoners is we're talking about getting these people, men and women, the best of us, the vanguard of our movement, out of jail, and we're fighting the same issues that they fought 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Is that not a lesson? And then the other lesson I say we must recognize is that the political prisoners of the Puerto Ricans are free except for one, Oscar Lopez Rivera. And so we know how to get people out of prison, but we're just not interested, because their formula was no Latino could be elected from a Latino district or whatever, voting, what would you call it, a community. You couldn't be elected unless you spoke of political prisoners, freeing their political prisoners. And they are all free. Now, what about us? We're supporting Obama. We're supporting Hillary. We're supporting, without a demand, free our political prisoners. We have to say it. We have to say it on the local level for your city councilman. And Betty Davis had some young people who were young women who were super active in their community, in jobs, in education. And I say, you have to run for office. But I'm going to ask you a question right now. And the question is, if you run for office, will you support the freedom of our political prisoners? And both of them, without hesitation, said, yes, numero uno. And I says, now you got my vote. You got my attention. And let's further discuss this. And so without my further discussing anything, I'm going to switch over to Sister Lynn Stewart. Dick, hang in there. We're waiting for you early. We're going to be an hour and a half this evening. Lynn, are you there?
I'm definitely here, and as just a little preface, I want to say if I could get my dear Larry and my dear Nellie together over a dinner table, I'm sure they would enjoy each other's company tremendously. I want to talk
promise.
Tonight, though. Go ahead.
Okay. I says, that's a promise you make. We're going to have to keep that. You hear that, Larry? Nellie? Go ahead, Len.
Yeah.
I do.
Okay.
Okey-doke.
I want to talk tonight about Leonard Peltier. This is a week that has been dedicated to working on his case. He has lately been thrown into solitary once again. Of course, if you do not know the history, just a brief thumbnail sketch. He was arrested for the murder of an FBI agent. And, of course, it was a time when the reservation was literally at war with authorities. They don't know who killed this FBI agent, but Leonard was an enemy, and they wanted to get rid of him. And, indeed, they have accomplished that through all these many years, although all the evidence against him shows his innocence. Now, that said, we are pressing. We are trying to press, along with the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, to bring Leonard home.
Mm-hmm.
He is in Coleman, Florida. I don't know how much further you could get from the reservation in South Dakota than that, but they have placed him there, and in my mind, it is no accident. They remove us from where they see as our seats of power when we go to prison. And I want to say that I want to enlist everybody listening in this week from tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday to call that guy in the White House, that Obama, that as some call him the Negro President, and to call him at this number, 202-456-1111. And I'm telling you to call him. You pick up your put it in your speed dial or your contacts or whatever you put it in. When you take out your phone to call your kids, to call the dentist, to call back into the office, whenever you take out your phone, hit that and call Mr. Obama and tell him to give clemency to Leonard Peltier, to not allow himself to be a pawn of the FBI who would keep Leonard in jail forever. Get on that phone. It's a little thing. It's a little thing for a man who has spent his whole productive life in jail. Call for Leonard Peltier, 202-456-1111. We would like to close down their phone banks. Do this thing. Do it for our brother. And in that light, I want to read a quick poem by our other great brother, Mondo, political prisoner, Omaha, Nebraska, ex-Panther, also framed up by the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. And the poem that he wrote is called Bloodlines. When we escaped the plantations of Florida and ran among the trees toward swampy ground to trudge through mud and memories of bondage and of blood, we found your arms swung open wide as gates to refuge from a weary fugitive parade. But there are those who would have us not remember this. You and we did not only hide and live in friendship side by side, we both being people of the drum. Did not our hearts thump out a battle song to drive our feet to march against the pale-faced ones whose bellies could not be filled, who had stolen us from our motherland and, too, were stealing yours from you? But there are those who would have us not remember this. With your Comanche warriors in Texas, we fought them. With your Seminole warriors in Florida, we fought them. With your Tuscarora's warriors in South Carolina, we fought them. Scant are the places where we did not together fight them. But there are those who would have us not remember this. Who would stuff our recollections full with the treacheries of those of ours who betrayed our common cause? The Creek slaveholders and mercenaries among the Choctaws, Buffalo soldiers who, though freed from chains by stroke of pen, were still enslaved of head and soul, and others who could not distinguish enemies from friends. There are those who would have us remember these as heroes, but the vistas of yesterday are wide, and we do not stand awake with one eye closed. Remember Leonard Peltier, call that man in the White House, make it miserable, make him do the right thing. This is richly deserved. This is an old alliance that we must continue to forge. That's it for me, Ralph. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, as usual, I say the lady with the words. Mungo wrote them, and you spoke them just so beautifully at a right moment. If this doesn't raise us up to fight for Leonard Peltier, and there's so many others, as you have been going around the country thanking people for what they did for you, we must make it a national mission for people of color to thank other people. And I'm talking about Mexicans who ended slavery in 1831, I believe, and where many black people have escaped to. So many black people, I went to Veracruz. I understand if you go there today, there's a large black population that didn't come directly from Africa. They came from America, escaping slavery. Anyway, thanks again, Lynn. Love that. And let's go to Dick, who has been so patient in waiting to tell us what he has to tell us this week. Any particular issue you'd like to talk about, Dick?
It was a very specific issue that I've been trying to get out for 3 weeks now. Because
I know you have been very patient, but come on, bring it to us.
I wanted to make, if you remember, the discussion we had many shows ago where I insisted that we should all use the term individual rights rather than human rights, because human rights human rights was used by rightists to distract us from the key issue, which was the fundamental principle that what I call the modern era achieved at its birth by the great leftists who spoke then. And that principle was the principle that human beings were born with inalienable rights, and that no laws or anything else could take these rights away from them, and that they were paramount and first. That principle, which hasn't fared too well but has stayed with us, I mark the modern era as being 1762 to 2008. We started the new era in January 21st of 2008, according to my analytic system. But originally, the key idea of the entire 250 years almost, from 1762 to 2008, was the very fact that all humans have inalienable rights. And this grew in time into, say, the famous statement by Jefferson in the Declaration of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and everything else. But that wasn't the point. The important point in his statement was reflecting what previous leftists had said, that we have inalienable rights. And what I'm trying to do in getting a vision for the new era is I am trying to put individualism on a new basis. Okay, so with that said, you remember that. I think the words we use are very important. So we should all
say let me interrupt you for one second, Dick, to say this is a theoretical discussion, because while all of these words of individual rights were being talked about, individuals were slaves. And so now, you know, yes, we have to deal with that. And I hope in the new era, we will put our theory together with reality in terms of individual rights.
Ralph, go ahead. That's the point.
Go ahead, continue.
But previous to the existence of a new theory of individualism, there nobody was thinking theory, and everybody was just describing what was happening in the world today. And we have 1,000 descriptions, and nobody could agree on anything. If you want agreement, it has to be on universal terms. And if you don't do theory, you don't know what's happening universally. What I'm saying is that when the rightists say human rights, they are trying to dissuade us from saying that individuals can have rights that the state cannot impose upon. And that to me was the fundamental idea that came out of the first quadrant of the modern era. All right. Now, then later in the second quadrant, starting around 1822, two other ideas came up of great importance, and I'm trying to get our terms straight here too, so that we don't buy the lie by using 19th century terms to discuss our economic issues when we should be using the 21st century terms that, you know, I will describe as a new way of seeing the issue. And that is the old argument between capitalism and socialism. And what is capitalism and socialism at all? So let me read a little bit from what I wrote on this in my book. I've made excerpts so that it's not the whole thing, but it will make the central point about what capitalism and socialism debate, what that debate is really all about. And I want to say how we should use our terms as a consequence if we're not going to miss the issue and let the rightists escape with distorting everything for us so that we're not talking truth. Let me just
interject one more thing here, that when you talk about capitalism, you cannot speak of capitalism without using in the terms and the reality of imperialism. This is what we're struggling
with. No. I'm going to interrupt you, Ralph, because you're quite right. What I'm going to say is let us stop saying capitalism when we want to talk about the terrors on the earth, and let us say imperialism. Then we're calling it what it is. But it's not capitalism in one sense. And I'm going to try to explain how we should use the words capitalism and socialism, if you will let me just read these. It's just two small pages.
Ooh, this is too long, Dick. To the chase. Give us a conclusion of the two pages discussing capitalism and socialism.
I'm trying to. I have cut out the things that shouldn't be discussed, but you won't understand it if I just make a statement. You'll say, oh, that's your opinion, and you won't see the reason behind it.
No, trust me. Trust me. The people listening
are pretty
hip. All right,
why don't you trust me, Ralph, and let me have 5 minutes, maybe seven, to read
this. 5 minutes. Go ahead. 5 minutes.
I'll try to get it in there. Let me go.
There's 20 people on the line. Go ahead. Make them happy, too.
All right, but it's not irrelevant. It's very relevant.
I didn't say it was. I just said do it as briefly as you possibly can.
You can't understand my conclusion if you don't understand the chain of reasoning that led up
to it. Get on with it.
Thank you. First, I should clarify what I mean by the term socialism and capitalism, which only entered our economic discussions in the second quadrant of the modern era, that is, after 1822. You remember Robert Owen, Fourier, those people invented socialism. Well, the socialists then went on to lead to that great book by Proudhon, What is Capital? And that book, in turn, led to the discussion of the creation of Marxism with the help of Engels. And then we came up to the end of that quadrant, which led, of course, to not only to the to Lenin's view of how to run a society, but also to Gentili's view of fascism and how it should be imposed on the government. So we made a lot of mistakes then, but okay. I wanted to point out that I'm using these two words, capitalism and socialism, now, not in the academic sense, but in the epistemic sense, that is, the psychologic sense, the ideas to which they refer to. And as we know, the chief benefits of pure capitalism are that it spurs individual initiative, productivity, and entrepreneurism and its chief failings are that it promotes poverty, excessive wealth, all forms of slavery, corrupt governments, selfishness, inhumanity, all kinds of criminal acts, political deceptions, and lies and immorality in general. The chief benefits of pure socialism are that it seeks to share a society's total wealth, resources, and responsibilities fairly, while its chief failings are that it imposes collectivism or anti-individualism on everyone and immorally uses the principles of that rightist political ideology to deny many, if not all, of the natural rights of real individuals. So while both these extreme systems have benefits, neither one is a valid system because it has fatal flaws as well, as it must, because all systemic reasoning requires two poles. The fatal flaw of capitalism is that it tolerates immoralities or the right of the strong to impose upon, destroy, or enslave the weak. And the fatal flaw of socialism is its anti-individualism and rejection of the inalienable rights of all real individuals, putting the state first, of course, which most people today know was the greatest achievement of our political reasoning in the entire modern era. Each of these extreme views, capitalism and socialism, is invalid because it denies the other. But neither one can be totally denied because they are both real and necessary parts of our practical reasoning. The consideration cycle, which is the name for my psychologic system, tells us that to reason correctly in any psychologic system, we must affirm the reality of both its poles, acknowledge their polar opposition, and then try to find their perfect reconciliation. This is so in all five of our psychologic systems. In our feeling system, it's like the problem of perfect love. Here you are the subjective pole, and your potential lover is the object. And when everything about your relationship is right for both of you, there is no clash or conflict, there is only perfection. Though everything is rarely right in a relationship, that's the goal we seek when we seek, that's the goal we are seeking when we say true love. And if we see that we can't achieve that ideal, then we usually compromise on some of its parts, often with the hope of making it a more perfect relationship later. The same is so in our judgment system. We know that a morally perfect person cannot be an egoist or an altruist, but must be both. That is, a perfect reconciliation of selfishness and unselfishness. And in power, a perfect political system is not leftism or rightism. It is individualism or collectivism. It is the perfect reconciliation of both those poles. Similarly, a perfect economic system is not capitalism or socialism. It is capitalism and socialism if we reconcile those extremes perfectly. If we don't, then we have a corrupt economic system like the ones we've had throughout our history. Now, the chief mistake that most traditionalists made in the past when they discussed economics is in assuming, from their bias for one pole over the other, that we must replace capitalism.
We'll continue this. You've gone on about 7 minutes now, and I would like to, at this point, go to San Francisco and hear what's happening out there, where what are we going to do about this corrupt system. And we're going to have a report on what happened in the Million Man March and what we proposed. Then. Okay, San Francisco, are you there? 510. Are you there? 510-974-9497. Are you there? Hello? Hello?
Sounds like you got a bad connection.
Report. Okay, we're going to go to Ann Lamb. Are you there, Ann?
Okay,
I am
Ralph.
Here.
Yes, Ralph.
Okay. You're there. Okay, come on with it.
Hello from San Francisco. I'm from the Bay Area, Richmond, California. So I talked to, I was looking at, I went to the Million Man March. And this is what the minister is working from, and platform. And I know you know I'm a member of the Nation of Islam, and we have our in-house meetings, and this is what we are doing. Now, the minister spoke from different angles. He didn't come from an angle where, you know, he came too heavy. He came with a specific agenda.
Ghetto.
And Ralph Hunter always speaks about it. Boycotting the enemy. Disarm the enemy financially. Hit them with hurt if they won't give you justice. There's no way you should keep dealing with these people where they won't give you justice. And then it was said that these individuals don't want to give you the job in these different corporation industries. They want you to work on these low slave jobs. And you're buying their products. You say boycott the Nikes, all the different industries where people go and give them and create this billion-dollar industry. Bring it down where the people where these industries will feel the wrath of the people who is the 99% and the black communities, and they funding these assaults and killings in the community and all these different things. So the minister is organizing around that in each city. And he's telling everybody who's serious about wanting to change for our people is now justice or else is a now situation that we got to tend to now, because we know what these people are about, what their agenda is, and the things that they want to plan as an upcoming event to enslave everybody and depopulate the planet. And from us knowing these things, that's what they want to do, we got to work around it. And to work around it is we can't keep funding the death of us. And the minister said that boycott these different industries. And another thing the minister said, to go on the justice or else, sign up, tell them what you want to do. In that area of the chapter of the Nation of Islam, go organize with them, because they are dealing with different people from different walks of life who want to seek change. And we are all agreeing upon the structure that we're going to take to the force change. So the minister, his whole platform is the force change from the open enemy through their wealth. They don't see nothing but wealth. So that's where we'll be working from, that platform, where we gonna know that, okay, don't keep giving them the ammunition to kill you by keep spinning and going to sleep and partying, no different than the Noah's Ark thing. You know how that story goes. Well, we got to get up before the flood comes, and we know what the flood is. So the minister is telling everybody to join up, see what's going on, everybody moving as one unit, on what to do, get the instructions on what we're going to do as a whole. And it has nothing to do with nobody's religious, spiritual beliefs. It has to do with all of our liberation. So that's the minister had wanted us to deal with at the Million Man.
What happened?
Well, she was having trouble getting through, so.
Yeah. All righty. Thank you so much for that. And as you have stated, this is one of the things that I've been saying for years. We have to have economic sanctions against those who work against us. And now, with that wonderful report, we're going to go on to... Oh, you did not talk about the boycott Christmas, Black Friday and Christmas. And so let us, we have time to hear more about that march. So hold on to that for next week. And now we're going to go on to Ann Lamb, who's going to give us a report, update on political prisoners from Jericho.
Hey, Ralph, how are you?
Pretty good, Ann. How are you making it today?
I'm a little exhausted. what can I say? I actually have a report, of course, once again, about our beloved freedom fighter, Robert Seth Hayes, who, as you know, has been having medical problems for quite some time. So one of our lawyers, Yves Rozon, has taken up his, going to be his lawyer, which is great, and she visited Seth today. So we have a little bit of an update. She says she had a good visit.
And what was the name of the lawyer again?
Yves Rozon.
Oh, Yves, of course. So,
yeah, you know, I'm sure you know Yves Rozon.
A grand jury resister.
Yes,
thanks,
she was
Glenn.
A grand jury resister back in the day. I remember that.
Me too.
Yeah. So,
okay, sorry, Ralph.
That's all right. So I had a good visit.
All right, go ahead.
She says, this is a little report from her. I had a good visit today with Seth. He feels that there's some momentum about his medical treatment, maybe because the Sullivan doctors are worried now that others are looking over their shoulders. She's been calling up to Sullivan and talking with the superintendent, and that he's getting more attention on a daily basis and with a specialist. So actually yesterday he saw the pulmonologist. So first of all, his weight is up a little bit. He now weighs 142 instead of just 130, largely due to the fact that he's preparing his own food. He was pleased with the visit to the pulmonologist, which happened yesterday, Monday, up at Coxsackie. And he intends to schedule for Seth a CT scan of his lungs, a CT scan of his heart, and blood work. The pulmonologist thought there might be some infection but needs more info. The other thing that Sheila told me yesterday, Seth's wife Sheila, another wonderful freedom-fighting person, was that the pulmonologist said to Seth, "Why didn't they bring you here sooner? Why did they wait so long for this to get so bad?" Because he's had that cough since May. And that cough has been getting worse and worse and worse. And it has been being ignored. All right? So, you know, this goes back to the medical murder. You know, murder by deliberate medical neglect. Sheila says straight up, they're trying to kill my husband. And she is right. They are trying to kill her husband. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So the pulmonologist thinks he might have some kind of infection. That's why he wants to do all these tests and see what's going on. He's very concerned. Seth does not get to carry his inhaler. This is interesting because even though they don't know what he has, they've been giving him an inhaler twice a day and also a nebulizer twice a day. But he doesn't get to carry the inhaler around with him like most people would, right? And so he needs to go to medical when he gets short of breath, which is often. "I'm going to look into this," she says in parentheses. He goes to 6-call every day at 7:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. to get his glucose levels tested. He has diabetes. To get his insulin and to use the nebulizer with additional medication. Seth reports that his sugar levels were 102 last night and 102 this morning. That's excellent. So this happens when he cooks his own food. Seth has been told he will get blood work done ready to hepatitis C on December 2nd, which is 3 months after the end of the treatment. He did that whole 12-week treatment. So until they test the blood, we don't know if the hep is totally gone. It hopefully is. Seth said to tell the doctors, which would be Dr. Barbara Zeller, who I know you all know for many years, and Dr. Lana Habash, that he is ordering his, there are two Jericho doctors on our medical team, he is ordering his October-November medical records and will send them out. Now, I will kick myself for this one. He wasn't able to order them because he had no money in his commissary. I will be sending him commissary money tomorrow. He is still interested in receiving the diabetic diet, which he believes Dr. Sidorowicz simply won't prescribe. Dr. Sidorowicz is the facility doctor at Sullivan. He is horrible. And so she puts in parentheses, which is also true, "This diabetic diet is a mystery. Although there is an available doc's directive that says there is one, you can find out what's in it. Colleagues at the Prisoner's Rights Project at Legal Aid have an outstanding FOIL request for information relating to the diet and will share it with me if and when they get it. I told them I've raised with Albany the issue of a visit to an endocrinologist, who of course is the diabetes specialist, which I'm pursuing," which would be wonderful if that comes through. Then, on the legal side, she says that she's going to investigate Seth's habeas corpus issue about being reviewed by the board under sentencing laws that weren't in effect when he was sentenced. The current parole law was passed in 1978. Seth was sentenced in 1973, I want to say. Okay? So he has a whole argument that it's unconstitutional for them to be retroactively applying this law, which is much worse for the inmates than it was the old law. The old law was much better. So she said this would apply to his board hearings before 2012 when COMPAS came into use. Now, this COMPAS is an assessment that they're supposed to take into account and never do. So she's going to check into the Habe thing. At the same time, he and I will prepare for his June 2016 board appearance. Seth agreed that at this point he isn't eligible for medical parole, but clearly there will be an argument about his health in any parole application. So this is just the latest update. You know, things have not been doing well for Seth for a long time. What is he now, 67? You know, he should have been out in 1998, according to the old law. You know, he did his minimum, 25, you know, no infractions, no problems, no nothing. You know, went to school, did classes, mentored young people, all the things that all of our prisoners are always doing. And, you know, to no avail, not only he, but, of course, everybody in New York State, pretty much, will be coming up for parole this coming year. So we're going to be very busy with parole campaigns because we have Herman Bell. We have going up in February.
And listen to what they're going to say.
Hello?
Yes, I'm here, Ann.
Oh, I did. I heard. I didn't know if somebody else was trying to talk. So we have first coming up for parole in February, Herman Bell. Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim are the poster boys for the PBA to run their vile campaigns. So they will be starting that very soon, the PBA. They do it every 2 years. They truck out, you know, they were convicted of, after like three trials, I think, they were convicted of the death of two police officers, Waverly Jones and Officer Piergentini, way back in 1971. So every year the PBA trucks out Piergentini's widow. She's the Maureen Faulkner, you know, of this case. She thinks they should die. They should have gotten a death penalty. They should never be released and blah, 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 blah.
All right, Ann.
You know what I mean?
We understand. And
so, you know, I'm just saying that's all going to be coming up soon, so we're going to have to really be on point.
We're going to have to deal with it when it comes up, and maybe we'll have a counter-demonstration.
Yeah, or a counter-press conference at the very least, you know.
Okay.
Sounds
we're going
to
have
me,
to
Ralph.
Jump. Pardon?
I said that sounds real good to me, and I really want to thank you, you know, for having me on your show, and you and Betty and Lynn and Larry Pinkney and everybody does excellent work. And I love to talk about the so-called elections. I call them the C-lections.
Okay, very, very good, Ann. We're going to have to switch. We have 20 people on here waiting. So
okay, no
we're
problem.
We're looking forward to having a report from you next week. And now we're going to Tom Syracuse.
All right.
Tom, are you there? Okay,
yes, I am.
Thank you, Ann. Okay,
thank
what do
you
think? Tell us what's on your mind this week.
Well, one of the previous speakers talked about the reconciliation of capitalism with socialism. And then he went to describe what he thought capitalism was, and he did a pretty good job of it. But when he tried to describe what socialism is, frankly, he left me totally confused. I hope that next week he will go into a little more detail of what he thinks socialism is. he seems to think that socialism has a fatal flaw in it, and that is that it is not primarily concerned with the rights of the individual. And I think that he couldn't be more off the base in thinking that. Yes, if we look at so-called previous socialist states that took place after the Russian Revolution, he's right. However, most socialists today do not consider the Soviet brand of socialism as the kind of socialism that that we are hoping will take over in the future. In fact, Bernie Sanders, he's one of these people who thinks that you can reconcile socialism with capitalism. He describes himself as a democratic socialist, and he holds up as an example of this reconciliation the Scandinavian countries, that they have single-payer health insurance, that they have all kinds of social safety net programs. However, the fact of the matter is that even the Scandinavian countries, which are really not socialist at all, they are capitalist countries that have managed to construct a social safety net for the majority of the people. That is beginning to disappear. And why? Because one of the fatal flaws of capitalism, as you pointed out, Ralph, is competition and imperialism. Now, a country like Sweden had a huge income from selling weapons to other countries, but now they're in competition with many other countries that make weapons. And this is true with the economies, the so-called advanced economies of Japan and Europe and the United States. The United States, after World War II, dominated the world market. And there was enough flexibility in this system to enable the working class to get ahead a little bit, to be able to buy a little house in the suburbs, a car, and send their kids maybe to a community college. And then when their kids graduated from community college, they were able to get a job with a salary that was enough to enable them to get their own apartment, to get married and support a wife and kids. Those days are over. And so this is what Sanders, I consider Bernie Sanders a stalking horse for Hillary Clinton in much the same way as this Dr. Carson or Donald Trump and the other jokers that come out on those ridiculous debates are stalking horses for a much more moderate candidate that the Republican Party will nominate. Because the people that run this country, and they're the same people that run the Democratic and Republican parties, are not the people that are engaged in these debates. They're not Hillary Clinton. They're not. And if Sanders wins by a miracle, if he wins the Democratic primary, which I don't believe he will, Sanders will not have a ghost of a chance to implement any of the programs that he supports, which is a national health care system, a job program, strengthen the unions, start withdrawing from our wars overseas, to raise taxes on the riches, on the wealthy, and to regulate the banks. He doesn't have a ghost of a chance to implement any of these things.
Would you wind up quickly?
So the question is, should a progressive even consider somebody like Sanders? And I say, no, we shouldn't, because what he is doing is he's putting out this lie that the Democratic Party is flexible enough, is big enough to bring in left-wing, progressive, socialist ideology and it is not. What Sanders, his role is to try to keep progressives in the Democratic Party, just as the role of Trump and his cohorts to try to keep ultra-conservative, wild, irrational right-wingers in the Republican Party.
Okay, thanks for the time. And now talking about these elections and the Frederick Douglass statement that the power concedes nothing without a demand. And let's go to Lisa Davis, who's talking to be happening in Washington, D.C. this coming weekend.
Hello?
How are you there, Lisa? You gonna...
I'm doing. How are you doing? Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and we're all listening with open ears to hear what's happening in Washington this weekend.
Well, fantastic, because in Washington, on the 7th and the 8th, that Saturday and Sunday, the Black is Back Coalition is going to be taking this all the way to the White House with the demand for Black community control of the police. We believe that it is important for us to elevate this political conversation to say that Black power matters. And unless we are controlling our own communities, unless we are controlling every aspect of it, we're always going to be vulnerable to the hands of an oppressive system that has always sought basically our blood and our destruction. And that's just the truth. So we are making the demand for Black community control of the police. We are encouraging people to go to the Black is Back Coalition website to download these petitions, to take these petitions to their city council, and to really put the demand forward that we want, that the community, the Black community, the operative word being Black and community, because as we know, we can have Black figureheads with so-called positions of power, and it doesn't mean anything because they will work for this, you know, this structure, this very oppressive structure. But we the people should be the ones to hire, to review, and they have to understand that they have to answer to us. And so we're going to be marching to the White House on Saturday the 7th. We're going to start in Malcolm X Park, which is on 16th and Euclid Street, Northwest in D.C. We're going to be gathering at 12 o'clock, and we plan to make the march for the White House at about 2 o'clock. And then we will convene with another rally at Lafayette Park on that day. And then on Sunday, November 8th, we're going to convene with a conference at the Blackburn Center Auditorium at Howard University, which is located 2397 6th Street Northwest. And that's going to be from 12 to 6. And then we're going to get into the implementing strategies for Black community control of the police and Black power. We also have various working groups. That's part of the Black is Back Coalition, the healthcare working group, the political prisoners working group, which, Ralph, you can tell people about that as you are the chair. But these are the things that we are going to be talking about strategies for implementation.
Well, thank you for that so much, Lisa. And I need not speak anymore because everyone knows where I am on Black political prisoners, and I'm going to up the ante a little bit in Washington at the conference. And so if you can be there, we have to exert our demands. And I see it's beginning to happen around the country. But we have to put this together. And, of course, as we have been doing over the years, what we've been calling for over the years is control of one's school system. Betty wants to say something there.
I want to say to Sister Lisa and to Brother Larry, Sister Lynn, and all the rest of our panel here tonight, although I know the UN a discussion of the structural racism against people of African descent all over the world is merely a smoke and mirrors. There were parents fathers in the audience, when it came to question time, one of the things the father of the young man, Tamir, I think his name was Tamir Rice, who was killed in Walmart, said, why should we tell our sons not to shoot back at the police? Well, one of the reasons most people don't shoot back at the police is because they are afraid of consequence. Well, maybe it's time the police felt some consequences. And this is what the parents, especially the fathers in the audience, were saying back to the UN. One father stood up and said, this is a civil war. We are at war, and it's time we stop holding our sons back. They need to defend themselves against the police. And I think not all of us can get out there and defend ourselves that way, but we can at least be the water that the fish swim in, and we can support them through boycotts, through marches, through boycotting Black Friday, to boycotting Christmas, and everything else we can do to support their right to live on this earth and to live in peace. And I want to give a shout-out to Brother McNally for that analysis. We know it is not complete. We understand that a scholar is a scholar, and we look forward to hearing more next week. But we will be responding to what you have given us so far and saying,
May I just make
Sister Lisa, Lisa, you also put online that you're going to be doing something, some workshops in the future regarding health. And when you do get those together, I think you definitely have to call that in here. And thank you for the announcement. Go.
The first one's going to be December 14th in Newark at Refell, 271 South 9th Street. As we know, Black women also have been brutalized by this system. And we're going to be getting into that and into the issue of Deborah Provera, the issue of police brutality, police violence against Black women, but also what the medical profession is doing, like Deborah Provera, and the way Black women, African women worldwide and other women of color also are being targeted with some of the most one of the most deadliest forms of birth control known, that in addition to causing increasing the risk of getting breast cancer, it also increases the risk of spreading the AIDS virus in our community. And they know this, and they continue to push it. The World Health Organization, the UN, and Planned Parenthood, they continue to market it as being healthy and safe. But to the African community, well, over 84% of the users. So I just wanted to get that announcement out, too, in Newark on the 14th.
Thank you so much, Lisa, and see you next week. And now we're going to switch to 917-526-4283. Are you there? 917-526-4283. Are you there? I see you are, but it's okay. Let's go to Joel, 678-531-0262. Are you there?
Yes, hello.
Yes,
hello.
Go ahead, Joel.
Yes, I wanted say something. Yes, I wanted to say something to put the discussion of the elections into a certain context, and that is that since the assassination of Kennedy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy as president, by the forces of the Central Intelligence Agency and other allied institutional structures within the United States government, at the behest of the most reactionary forces, we are not really living in even the trappings of a democratic republic. And I believe that the way to understand that is that in up until 1947, there was still, however corrupt and reactionary and repressive, there was still a machinery of an elected officialdom that was governing the country, albeit on behalf of the rich and super rich. In 1947, the Congress passed, and President Truman at the time signed into law. He later said that it was a great mistake on his part. What was called the National Security Act, which created a new governmental structure with dual power. It was including 14 intelligence agencies supposedly coordinated by the Central Intelligence Agency. And in the Kennedy assassination, what we had was a collision between the two structures and the demonstration by the CIA that it was running the country, that Kennedy had said he wanted to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and of course he died pretty quickly after that. And ever since then, what we've had is a decision-making apparatus that is rooted in a dictatorship of these intelligence agencies and political police. And the elections are a hollow fraud in which only people who are approved by that structure can get to run in any important election, presidential, congressional. There are no exceptions. And the way you can see this is that there is not one elected official who will explain the Kennedy assassination from anything but the official viewpoint, which scapegoats one Lee Harvey Oswald as a supposed lone assassin. Every single official, senators, Congress members, even city council members, you don't see one. Those who tell even a smidgen of the truth about the Kennedy assassination are relegated to the realm of the conspiracy theorists, and they're basically at the door of mental institutions in terms of the kind of image that's been created about the central truth. Everybody else goes along with the big lie, and that big lie is also used to perpetuate the illusion of democracy. That is, that we're actually participating in some kind of election where the people decide whether this one or that one will be in nominal charge of the country. And of course, it has to be said that the important decisions are not even made by them. Like, take the President of the United States is supposed to be the most powerful elected official. But the President wakes up, he is briefed for 3 hours every day by the intelligence agencies, the political police, and other manipulators that come directly from the interests of the rich and the super rich as a club, as an oligarchy. And when you get briefed every day for 3 hours and you've got things to do during the day, probably you can't even get a chance to read a newspaper, as bad as that is, or to do net surfing or anything. And you have these institutional people surrounding you that are feeding you information. That means that you're largely powerless, because they're going to act on their basis. They're going to control the bureaucracy, the military, the police that are surrounding you, and you'll just have to get up on TV and explain why they're doing all of this in your name. So that's the kind of a system that we have. It's not a democracy, would mean the rule of the majority of the people, at least in accordance with the interests of the majority. And what we have is a tiny oligarchy. We used to say millionaires and billionaires. I think now you have to say billionaires and trillionaires, because this component, which is sometimes we say, you know, the 1% versus the 99%, but really it's 1% of the 1% of the 1% that's calling all the major shots, and everyone else is just getting exposed to brainwashed media that they own. And they're experts at doing what they're doing. But once we become aware of it, then we have the tools to fight back. And
all right, y'all.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for that. And
Well, thank you. Can I add something else to what Bill said?
Go ahead.
I'd just like to point out that if the CIA cabal thought that they were going to gain and get what they want by killing Kennedy, that could only have been because they knew that Johnson would be there to do what they want. And in that case, Johnson was a probable co-conspirator also. My suggestion.
Yeah. Of course, he was the first post-Kennedy assassination president. Yes.
May I say something, Tom?
Go ahead, John.
Well, considering that many of us, myself included, believe that this is not a democracy by any stretch of the imagination, nor it ever was,
yep.
And that the whole political system is a sham, the question comes up whether progressive people of goodwill, socialists, and the people on the left should participate in this sham. Should we have candidates and try to get, in other words, by participating in this sham, we are actually adding to this illusion that somehow we have a democracy here, and that the political system can represent various beliefs. And I think I'm coming to the conclusion that the only way any self-respecting leftist party, whether it be a socialist party or a green party, should participate in any election is that they should make it clear in their literature and in their debates that we do not believe that this is a democracy, and that there is no chance that any of these parties could ever win an election in the way the system is set up, but that we are participating in this in order to expose the duplicity of the system. That's why we're in it.
Yes, that's well said, Tom. This is why we're in it. You can't win it unless we're in it. And it's an educational process. And we have to recognize every day we're being educated to how far below there is below and what we're really up against. And if we were ever to win an election, they would do the same thing they do to people around the world. Elections, and you don't have to go very far. Let's just go to Haiti with Aristide, 72% of the electorate, and they threw him out. Now, this is
right. Duplicated
around the world, and we can go to places that are in the news today. Iran, a democratically elected person who came up against the oil company, British Petroleum, and it was about money. And so they overthrew him. And so what makes us think that if we were to come up against the interests of the super rich, that we must be prepared not to be overthrown. And with that said, let us run into 731-343-1215. You've been waiting. 731-343-1215. Are you there? Alrighty, one more time. 731-343-1215. If not, let's move to 917. Wait a minute. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just getting it off of mute, and just to be brief, I'm just taking in the conversation, and also just wanted to add to. That's you and Sister Lynn, who I had talked to. I'll be just following up with you on that probably in the next day, but had some good movement on that. And I'm just one thing about the conversation too. I know someone had mentioned control of our community, policing in black communities, and someone in turn mentioned education. That's one subject that has been a particular focus of mine before my son was executed, and I think it's something that needs to be taken up more in terms of the concept of liberation. And not going to go into a lot here, Brother Ralph. I know you don't have that much time, but that's how I think, and that's how I would like to join that discussion, because I am convinced at this point that liberation is not going to come through a fixed or reformed system any more than justice is going to come from reforming, you know, some laws and so forth. But that's something I you know, love to take up as far as the discussion in the future.
Yeah. Mike for next week, and now we're going to switch on to 678-531-0262. Are you there? Mary, 678-531-0262. Are you there? Hello? I can hear you. If not, let us move on.
This is Joel again. Can I go ahead, Joel? Get one other question in? And that is, has anybody considered creating an alternative election? I don't mean where we participate as a minor party and we get 2% of the vote acknowledged. Maybe it was really 20%, who knows. But an alternative election in which we elect like a shadow government, as they do in certain countries, among progressive forces, and more begin to look at ourselves as presenting an alternative which is legitimate and which is truly democratic. It may not have large forces now, but as an alternative election, it could make a certain type of challenge to the official election and really begin to build some form of a constituent assembly in the United States that can possibly even begin to take over governmental responsibilities democratically elected function.
Ralph, can I? Would anybody be interested in Ralph? Would anybody be interested in hearing the question that I submitted to Rachel Maddow, who was holding the debate, the Democratic debate, this Friday night? And she asked for contributions of questions to ask the candidates. And I wrote this one out for her to ask Hillary Clinton. All right? You want to hear it?
Go ahead.
She won't read it, of course. She won't read it, of course, but that's another matter. She won't ask her, but anyway. Mrs. Clinton, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Mrs. Clinton, do you support the traditional but unspoken rightist assumption that a government must allow the income and the accumulated wealth of individuals or collectives of any kind to increase infinitely or without limit? And if not, will you, if you become president, at long last propose reasonable caps on both excess income and excess wealth, with the excess collected by the government to be used first to end poverty in our society forever?
Great ending of a program, and we will pick up where we left off next week. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Thank you,
Richard.
Pardon? Great. And so we will see you next week, and our theme. Thank you.
wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear. Not a whole round will hear.